Beyond Barbarossa, Episode 87, The Axis Collapses. Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Red Beard Studio on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg Algonquin people, also called Ottawa, in free, sovereign, and independent Canada. As usual, I'm assisted today by the indispensable Ragnar the Magnificent Ragdoll and Daisy the Danger Doodle. This is episode 87, and we're going to be dealing with the advance of the Red Army and its new allies into Axis member Hungary, and the way that the final, almost final, Axis member Hungary, well, its relationship with Nazi Germany changes. Last episode brought the Red Army up to the Baltic Sea, where they trapped diminished German forces in two pockets, as well as to the border of Germany itself. Farther south, the Romanians and Bulgarians had switched sides, and Romanian armed forces were fighting alongside the Red Army up to their western borders. As I've tried to illustrate, the Eastern Front of World War II was a very big area. Throughout the war in the East, there were more players involved than just the two main combatants, Germany and the USSR. In the countries occupied by Germany, like Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Poland, and Ukraine, and even in nominal Axis members like Italy, Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria, multiple factions operated at the same time, often switching sides and often fighting even against each other. And within all these countries, there were opposing political factions and movements as well. Pro-Nazi, nationalist, communist, socialist, and more. So, in addition to being a very big place, the Eastern Front is a very complicated theater of operations. And that means it takes a long time to describe. And it makes rich ore for mining many, many stories and books. All that to say, this podcast, which has always tried to track the development of the war on the Eastern Front, more or less chronologically, with that 81-year delay, is still in September and October of 1944. The Soviet Union's many Red Armies were conducting overlapping operations in several places all along the 1,500-kilometer front in 1944, the front that stretched from the Baltic Sea to the Balkan Mountains. This required a lot of resources, more than any single armed force had ever amassed before. Not only millions of people to fight and more to supply them, but never before seen amounts of food, clothing, weapons, ammunition, and vehicles. By late 1944, the reassembled Soviet weapons factories were going flat out. As Angus Wallace pointed out in episode 79, the Red Army's rapid advance westward would have been impossible without the 400,000 or more trucks the Americans provided through Lend-Lease. This episode is going to describe the advance of the Red Army into Central Europe in the autumn of 1944, and how that brought about the final political collapse of the Axis in Europe. As we saw last episode, two Axis members, Romania and Bulgaria, switched sides in the fall of 1944, from being Axis members or allies to joining the Western Allies and the Soviet Union. So that's what we're going to get into. But before we do that, it's time for a shorter version of what else is happening in the war. This regular feature, this episode, is going to be briefer than usual because it covers much of the same period as we did last episode. So these are mostly items that I didn't mention last time. Ninth of October, 1944. The Moscow Conference begins. Churchill and Stalin discuss spheres of influence in the post-war Balkans. 10th October, Allied combined forces take the city of Corinth in Greece. On the 12th, the Greek National Liberation Front liberates Athens from the Nazis. 2 days later, British troops arrive. 18th October, Hitler orders all surviving men from 16 to 60 in Germany who are not yet in the military to take up new duties in the Volkssturm militia, the Home Guard of Germany. October 20, the Red Army and Yugoslavian partisans liberate the capital of Belgrade. The Yugoslavian partisan leader is Josip Broz, better known to most people as Tito. 23rd, the Allies recognize General Charles de Gaulle as the head of a provisional French government. The same day, American B-29 bombers begin using Tinian Island in the Marianas chain in the Pacific as their base for bombing Japan. Then on the 25th, there are three separate air engagements in the Battle of the Leyte Gulf. U.S. Navy warplanes launched from aircraft carriers destroy many Japanese ships in the waters off the Philippines. That same day, Romanian and Red Army troops complete the liberation of Romania, or they complete driving out the Nazis. However, Romania's free future will change. 1st November 1944. British forces occupy Salonika in northern Greece and distribute badly needed food in Athens, which is facing a severe shortage. The same day, Canadian and British units begin Operation Infatuate, landing on Walcheren Island in the mouth of the Scheldt River in Belgium. This was done to open up the sea approaches to allow Allied shipping into the major port of Antwerp. This would allow them to use that as a base to bring in forces and supplies. This, however, takes longer than anticipated and is known as the Forgotten War. 2nd November. Canadians complete the liberation of Belgium when they capture Zeebrugge. 4th November, the last Axis forces withdraw from the Greek mainland, but other German units would remain in several islands until the end of the war. 5th November, U.S. planes bomb Singapore for the first time. Meanwhile, kamikaze attacks cause heavy damage to the aircraft carrier USS Lexington. November 7th. 1944 was Election Day in the United States. Franklin Roosevelt would become the first and so far last U.S. president to win a fourth consecutive term as president of the United States. 9th November, American troops and tanks cross the Moselle River and threaten Metz, Germany. And on the 12th, the Royal Air Force's repeated bombing operations finally succeed in sinking the German battleship Tirpitz, which is anchored in a fjord at Tromsø, Norway. So now to focus on the central purpose of this podcast, the Eastern Front. Focus on a country that hasn't had much attention in this podcast yet, Slovakia. Not the Slovakia of today, but that of 1939 to 1945, which roughly corresponds to the same geography. So, let's cast our minds back to 1939. When Germany gave up all pretense and took over all of Czechoslovakia, It divided the country into the Protectorate of Bohemia-Moravia and the nominally independent state of Slovakia with a puppet Nazi government. The Czechoslovak government, the real one, the legitimate one, went into exile, eventually and settling in London like the Polish government would sometime later. Slovak troops participated in Germany's invasion of Poland in 1939, in Operation Barbarossa in 1941, and continued to fight alongside Army Group B all the way to the Caucasus Mountains in 1942. Of course, this meant they also shared the fate of the Germans as they retreated from the Kuban bridgehead and then across Ukraine in 1943. On 29th August 1944, resistance forces in Slovakia began the Slovak National Uprising. It was the second largest resistance rising against the Nazis after the Warsaw Rising, which began almost a month earlier. And it also began less than a week after Romania switched sides to the Allies. On 31st August, the Stavka, the Soviet military high command, ordered General Ivan Konev to draw plans to cross the Carpathian Mountains to support this rebellion and crush the Germans in Slovakia. So on the 8th of September, the 38th Army and the Czechoslovak First Army Corps, an exile group of Czechoslovakian military in the USSR, formed from those who fled after Germany's occupation in 1939, crossed the Dukla Pass over the Carpathians, the pre-war border between Poland and Czechoslovakia. Their plan was to cross the mountains and reach the town of Prasov in 5 days. However, they met much stronger resistance than they expected from the 1st Panzer Army and units of the Hungarian 1st Army. After 3 days, the Red Army did not even get halfway to their first objective. A battle to capture one hill in the Dukla Pass lasted 10 days, costing tens of thousands of casualties on both sides. It took nearly a month for this Red Army Czechoslovak operation to reach Slovakia itself. That was on 6 October. By then, the Germans were well on their way to crushing the Slovakian uprising. The same day that the Red Army arrived, meanwhile, other Red Armies were about to move a little farther south. You can see this in Map 1 on the webpage for this episode. Evan Maudsley sums up the operation into Slovakia this way. The Slovakian initial uprising was a missed opportunity. If the uprising had been successful, it might have had a significant impact on the war, outflanking Hungary. There were mutual recriminations later about the competence of the Slovak rebel officers and the London government, and about whether the Soviets gave less help than they might have done. Ultimately, the cause of the fiasco was the difficulty of changing sides at the right moment, a problem not confined to Slovakia. End quote. To shift our attention a bit farther south, that same day, 6th October, when the Red Army finally made it into Slovakia, Stavka ordered another group, the 2nd and 3rd Ukrainian Fronts — fronts are groups of armies, remember — ordered these two fronts to invade Hungary, heading toward its capital, Budapest, through a city called Debrecen. Now, just a quick aside on Ukrainian fronts. The Red Army regularly changed the names of these army groups depending on where they were operating. So, on 20 October 1943, so let's go back a year, the Steppe Front, led by Colonel General Ivan Konev at the Battle of Kursk, was renamed the 2nd Ukrainian Front. In May, General Rodion Malinovsky took command of this front from Konev, as he, Konev, was promoted to Marshal of the Soviet Union and shifted to the 4th Ukrainian Front, which was situated to the north of the 2nd. Now, the name Malinovsky might sound familiar to you regular listeners. Rodion Malinovsky was a veteran of the Battle of Stalingrad. Commanding the Southern Front in 1942, he kept Hermann Hoth's 4th Panzer Army from encircling Stalingrad, and his forces took part in Operation Uranus, which ultimately trapped and destroyed the German 6th Army in Stalingrad. Promoted to head the southern front, which pushed the Germans out of Rostov on Don and then out of the Donbass, the Don River Basin in eastern Ukraine. Yes, the Donbass is part of Ukraine, not Russia. Always has been, never Russian. Anyway, after that, Malinovsky commanded the southern front, the group of armies in southern Ukraine, which took Zaporizhia, the downrivermost section of Ukraine. That was when the Southern Front was renamed the Third Ukrainian Front, and Malinovsky was promoted to full general. In May 1944, Malinovsky was moved to command the Second Ukrainian Front and ordered to continue its advance westward. Command of the Third Ukrainian Front, Malinovsky's previous group of armies, was given to Fyodor Tulbulkin, another veteran of Stalingrad. So, in 1944, we have these two fronts, two complete Red Army groups with full armament and American Studebaker trucks surging into eastern Hungary. Hungary was clearly unprepared to face Romania at this point, let alone the immense Red Army. From one of the pre-1990 histories, Stalingrad to Berlin by Earl F. Ziemke. Hungary, never a pillar of strength in the German coalition, had since Romania capitulated been in a state of acute internal political tension. By 24 August, the internal condition of Hungary appeared so uncertain that the OKW moved two SS divisions in close to the capital to be ready to put down an anti-German coup. The first overt alarm was raised on 7 September when, in a flash of panic touched off by a false report that the Russians were in Arad on the undefended south border, 140 miles from Budapest, the Hungarian Crown Council met in secret and later, through the chief of staff, presented an ultimatum to the OKH. If Germany did not send five panzer divisions within 24 hours, Hungary would reserve the right to act as its interest might require. Guderian called it extortion. End quote. Germany dealt with the situation exactly as you'd expect a tyrant to do. Hurrying Heinz Guderian, now recovered from his disfavor in Hitler's eyes and acting chief of the General Staff of the Army High Command, sent panzer divisions to Budapest just to protect the puppet government and reassure the people that they'd be shot if they thought about emulating Romania's defection. And now it's time for a short break. Be right back.
As Scott elegantly describes in each episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the war on the Eastern Front was truly gargantuan, both in terms of its geography and its destructiveness. But given that there is so much territory to cover, and that so many millions of men were involved in the fighting, it's perhaps inevitable that some battles from the Eastern Front get overlooked. I'm David Sumner, and I'm the host of Europe at War, a weekly podcast exploring lesser-known battles and stories of the Second World War, with a particular focus on the Eastern Front. From the drama of thousands of trapped German soldiers and terrified civilians attempting to break out of the Halba Pocket, to the unexpected and blistering counterattack launched by German forces on the Red Army during the Battle of Bautzen, many of the Eastern Front's most dramatic battles, particularly those which happened towards the end of the war, have long been neglected by historians, and their stories have remained untold, until now. So to hear these incredible tales from the Eastern Front, and more, check out Europe at War, available on all podcast platforms. Thank you. Now let's get back to the show.
Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. Beyond Barbarossa is still, as far as I can tell, the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland, and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Thanks for coming back to part 2 of episode 87 of Beyond Barbarossa, The Axis Collapses. As the 2nd and 3rd Ukrainian Fronts, just to clarify here, the soldiers in these fronts weren't necessarily Ukrainian. Many were, but not all. These units are just called that because they had more or less been operating in Ukrainian territory. Anyway, as these two army groups advanced through Romania into Hungary, they destroyed 13 Axis divisions. That's right, 13 Axis divisions killed, captured, and otherwise erased. Whole divisions of the once mighty Wehrmacht. But the Wehrmacht, though diminished, was still a deadly foe, and they inflicted huge casualties on the Soviets at the same time. For their successes in September, both Malinovsky and Tolbukhin were promoted from general to marshal of the Soviet Union, the highest Soviet military rank. On 14 September, those two fronts began an offensive toward Belgrade, capital of Yugoslavia, but a counterattack by German Army Group South, at this point commanded by General Johannes Friesner, stopped them. After weeks of heavy fighting without results, Stavka called off the attack at the end of the month and gave the Ukrainian fronts new orders to drive westward toward Budapest along two axes or in two separate directions. From the north, around the city of Arad, Romania, the 46th Soviet Army, the 1st Romanian Army, and Cavalry Mechanized Group Pliev, commanded by Lieutenant General Isa Pliev, would advance toward Budapest. Farther south, starting from Oradea, the 6th Guards Tank Army, the 53rd Army, and Cavalry Mechanized Group Gorshkov were to attack from the north, moving toward Debrecen. These two spearheads would perform a classic pincer movement and encircle the German and Hungarian forces. But at the same time that Stavka was issuing these orders and the 2nd and 3rd Ukrainian fronts were getting ready to carry them out, German Army Group South Commander General Oberst Johannes Friesner ordered his forces to attack toward Oradea, the starting point for the Red Army's northern pincer. You can see how this is playing out in Map 2 on the webpage for this episode. To quote again from Stalingrad to Berlin, Friesner was far short of the strength both to fight the battle at Cluj and establish a front west of there. On 20 September, a minor Russian onslaught threw back to Arad the Hungarians covering his flank on the west, and the following day they gave up the city without a fight. Ziemke goes on to say, losing Arad sent another wave of panic through Budapest. Even though the Army Group, redesignated Army Group South at midnight on 23rd September, was certain that Malinovsky did not yet have enough strength at Arad to attempt to strike out for Budapest. End quote. As mentioned last episode, This is the time that a Hungarian delegation went to Moscow to seek a separate armistice, a move that the Germans did not appreciate. Heinz Guderian sent, quote, several strong panzer units to rest and refit just outside Budapest, according to Ziemke. The Hungarians' nervousness was premature, but not by much, end quote. On 6 October, that's the same day the 1st Ukrainian Front finally took the Dukla Pass, Malinovsky's 2nd Ukrainian Front attacked from Arad, quote, slicing through the German 3rd Army, end quote. The leading Soviet units advanced almost 60 kilometers or 40 miles until they were slowed up by the 1st Panzer Army and 23rd Panzer Division. The Germans brought up reserves to hold the 2nd Ukrainian Front back and sent the 23rd Panzer Division to Arad to lead a counterattack. Even so, the next day, the 2nd Ukrainian Front's southern group reached the Tisa River. From there, they advanced northward from Arad toward Debrecen, which is about 100 kilometers or 60 miles. That's a great distance in military terms. Meanwhile, the 23rd Panzer Division, remember how they were going to lead the counterattack at Arad? So yes, these two forces met in the middle. By 9th October, the Red Army forced the Germans to retreat from Oradea and dig in at Debrecen. As a crow flies, maybe 40 miles over the roads and paths in the area, close to 90 kilometers or 55 miles. From Debrecen, the panzers counterattacked, encircling Red Army units. The full Battle of Debrecen began on 11th October, as Pliev's cavalry group reached Debrecen. Back at Oradea, well, I'll let Earl Ziemke describe it. Quote, the next day, 11 October, 6th Guards Tank Army put up a violent fight to get the encircled corps out. Who had trapped whom began to become unclear. The flat Hungarian plain became the scene of one of the wildest tank battles of the war. Malinovsky reined in on his other armies. By the 12th, the Russians were in the pocket, were shaking themselves loose, and Friesner ordered Army Group Völler to start back again. On the 14th, the Russians were clearing the pocket, and Army Group South began concentrating on getting a front strong enough to keep them from going north once more. End quote. On the 15th, Horthy, the regent of Hungary, told the German envoy in Budapest that they had signed an agreement with Moscow to follow Romania and Bulgaria's example and declare war on Germany. But the Germans were one step ahead. Hitler had sent two specialists to Budapest for, let's call it, moral support, political support. There we go. These specialists were SS General von dem Bock-Zaluski, who managed the Warsaw Rising for Germany. In other words, commanded the brutal suppression of Polish sovereignty. And with him was SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny, commander of the SS team that busted Mussolini out of prison in Italy. Budapest, consider yourself managed. The 2nd Ukrainian Front occupied Oradea, linking up with Pliev's cavalry group and cutting off more German troops. Meanwhile, the 4th Ukrainian Front attacked the German 8th Army, part of Völler's group. On 15 October, Hitler's SS henchmen in Budapest, quote, persuaded Horthy to accept asylum in Germany, end quote. They installed Ferenc Szálasi, a more pliable Nazi stooge, to run the country. To give you a better idea of what this episode was really like, I'm going to read a short passage from Antony Beevor's The Second World War. Skorzeny persuaded Bock-Zaluski not to repeat the same heavy-handed tactics and avoid smashing the citadel into submission. Instead, on the morning of 15 October, just before Horthy's announcement of the armistice, Skorzeny's SS commandos managed to kidnap Horthy's son in a street ambush. After a shootout with his bodyguards, Miklos Horthy was trussed up, flown to Vienna, and transferred to Mauthausen concentration camp, which already contains such Promontorian as Francisco Largo Caballero, the former Prime Minister of the Spanish Republic. Horthy was told bluntly that, if he persisted with his treason, his son would be executed. The admiral, although in a state of nervous collapse at the threat, went ahead with his broadcast. Arrow-crossed stormtroopers seized the building immediately afterwards and put out a denial, insisting on Hungary's determination to fight on. End quote. And the result, as the Romanians and Soviets were getting closer, the Hungarian chief of the army staff, several officers, and even whole army units defected to the Soviets. Now, anyone could see that Hungary was de facto out of Germany's hands by this point, with not only the Red Army swarming over the border from several directions at once, but also troops of their former ally, Romania, and with Hungarian military people deserting or going over to the other side. The smart, strategic thing to do would have been to pull out of the country and firm up the defenses on your own side of the border. Hitler characteristically issued these sensible orders to Army Group South, the one operating in Hungary, to, quote, see the battle through at Debrecen, end quote, and for Army Group Völler to advance eastward to the Tisza River. In other words, to hit hard and reconquer the country, something they had no hope of doing, which would become painfully obvious very soon, if it wasn't already. As you smart listeners anticipated, three Romanian divisions soon captured Debrecen. 3 days after that, Pliev's cavalry group captured the town of Nyíregyháza, cutting off Völler's 8th Army. The Germans sent another three divisions, including Tiger II tanks, and recaptured the town, allowing the 8th Army to escape encirclement. This still did not stop the Red Army from advancing west. Friend of the podcast, Anthony Tucker Jones, explains it. Having blunted the Soviet advance, the Germans and Hungarians lost up to 35,000 killed or missing, as well as 500 tanks and 1,656 guns and mortars. Some 20,000 to 40,000 Axis troops were captured. The Red Army sustained 11,900 dead and 6,662 missing, as well as 358 tanks knocked out, end quote. So as you can see, huge casualties on both sides. The result of these operations, counterattacks and counterattacks by the end of 1944, the Red Army was situated well west of the Transylvanian Alps. Yes, those Transylvanian Alps, which the Germans had hoped would form a natural barrier against the Red Army for the winter of 1944 to 1945. So much for that hope. Now we have to shift our attention northward, where the Red Army at the same time was moving into actual German territory, East Prussia. But we'll have to save that for next episode, when we examine the Battle of Gumbinnen and the atrocities committed there in October and November 1944. For now, thank you for listening to this episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast that tells the whole story of the Eastern Front of World War II. As always, there are pictures and maps on the webpage for this episode, beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com. And then click on the title for this episode, The Axis Collapses. If you found I've made any errors, please let me know. Reach me by email, scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca, or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. Please consider following Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting app, and I'd really appreciate a rating or a review on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, or whichever podcasting platform you listen on. Doing that really helps spread the word to others who might be interested in this area of history and don't know that the show is here. If you like this episode and want to help me keep it going, consider joining my Patreon, patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa, and then choose whatever level of support you want. Until all Ukrainian refugees can return home safely, your financial support will go to charities that help the Ukrainian refugees. The first donation from your support went to the Canada-Ukraine Foundation's Ukraine Humanitarian Appeal, as described in episode 84 in September. As always, a special thank you to those who are supporting this podcast now. Add your name to that list. It's easy. Once again, the address is patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. Morse Code Sounds from Thane Brown. I'm Scott Burry. Until next episode, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina, et vive le Canada!